I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Thank you for joining us today for The American Idea. I am Kara Rogers-Stevens, Associate Professor of History here at Ashland University. Our topic today is an appropriate one for tax season. We are going to be talking about money. Now, since I'm a Jefferson scholar, the topic of money and how important it is to handle money well has come up quite a bit in my own historical research. Today, I'm thrilled to get to speak to an author whose new book is entirely devoted to investigating how presidents have the same financial concerns as the rest of us. Debt, investing, how to create financial stability. Although, of course, the presidents are also dealing with, you know, the unique issues of running for office and leading the nation. My guest for this conversation is Megan Gorman. Megan is founding partner of Checkers Financial Management, a San Francisco-based firm specializing in tax and financial planning for high net worth individuals. She holds a BA in history from Bryn Mawr College. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Bryn Mawr College?
Yeah, Bryn Mawr, yes.
Yep. Bryn Mawr. I just had a conversation with somebody yesterday about how to correctly pronounce this.
You can do the Katharine Hepburn version, which is Bryn Mawr. But yeah, Bryn Mawr is perfect.
Oh, I like that. Okay. And you also have a law degree from Rutgers. Past career positions include Goldman Sachs and BNY Mellon Wealth Management. Megan is currently senior contributor at Forbes, writing on personal finance and income tax, and frequently quoted in other financial media outlets, including the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, CNBC, and US News. Welcome to the show, Megan.
Kara, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to this, especially talking to someone who's a Jefferson expert.
Oh, yes. We're going to have fun.
Fascinating.
In so many ways, he is.
Yes.
Now, in the introduction to your new book, and I want to make sure that I get the title of this correct. It's The President's Money. Tell us, what's the subtitle of this book?
All the President's Money, How the Men Who Governed America Govern Their Money.
How they govern their money. Perfect. Yes. Now, in your introduction, you offer two key concepts regarding personal finance: financial fragility and financial resiliency. Fragility you define as being unable to cope with an emergency expense in a short period of time. And the statistic you give is one that I've heard before, and it's always a little horrifying, that the typical American, about 50% of Americans can't handle an unexpected $400 expense. Is that still accurate?
So that's from the Federal Reserve, that statistic. Okay. And that was coming out of the 2008 to 2010 crisis. So I would say probably with inflation, it's probably still fairly accurate. And what we find with most Americans is, you know, an unexpected medical bill or a car breaking down can really unwind their finances. So if you think about where we are today historically, you know, with inflation up, you know, the cost of living harder than it ever has been, and eggs costing $10, that statistic really still resonates. It's hard today financially. And I think it's important for people to understand that.
Wow. Okay. So fragility is being unable to cope with an emergency expense in a short period of time. Then you contrast that with resiliency, and you define this as the ability to withstand life events that impact one's income and or assets. You say researchers typically point to a variety of factors that create such resiliency, including being positive, flexible, focused, organized, and proactive. But interestingly, you also say that you have advised high net worth individuals who struggle, despite having lots of wealth, to remain resilient. You say they're wealthy, but competing against the pull of fragility. So what's going on there? Why doesn't having a lot of money equate to being financially resilient?
Yeah, and this is where, you know, the presidents can be interesting when you look at them. But when you ask most people, what is the point of finance, right? What are you trying to achieve in personal finance? You might hear, I want to get rich, right? I want to have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And that's not really the technical thing that you should be focusing on. You want to be able to weather the ups and downs of your financial life, you know, getting divorced, having a child, paying for education, right? All of those things put stresses on our money. And what it requires of us is to, one, have the opportunity to have money. So, you know, that's the first threshold. So, and then the second part is having the discipline and the skills and the traits to be able to make the right decisions. Money is really, you know, a mix of numbers and psychology. And so a lot of times when I work with people, you would think, well, they've got so much money. Why are they worried? But getting to the right decision point is incredibly difficult. And in studying the presidents, it was not shocking to find that a lot of them struggle with financial decision making. Now, some of them struggled, like Lincoln, and eventually became quite good at it. Others struggled their whole life, like Jefferson, and never really mastered the ability to be resilient. And that's what's really fascinating, because when you look at money and you look at how people do financial decision making, you're looking at their humanity. It makes them, I found the presidents, and I've always loved the presidents since I was a little kid, studying their money made me feel I knew them as people.
Oh, wow.
And you get close to people. And because it's, you know, when I was working with the LBJ Library, they showed me a letter Johnson wrote in the 1940s to a friend saying, I was up at 2 a.m. worried about money. And there were other letters Truman had saying similar things. And I don't know about you, Cara, but I wake up at 2 a.m. worried about money. Hmm. And if you think about it, it's a very universal thing. And when you're worried about money, you're worried about your resiliency, because you're worried that you might become too fragile to be able to live the life that you live financially. And this is what I think sort of connects us all together, including the presidents. Now, to be fair, unfortunately for the presidents, money is often used against them in a political standpoint. And that's not what interests me about them with money. It's what makes them human.
Okay. So it's, how is their approach toward money giving us new information about their personalities?
Yep. And their philosophies and who they are and what kept them up at night. Because mm-hmm. I think there's this tendency, and I take George Washington, you know, he's always on that pedestal, right? Yes. We never pull him down. And the thing is, he was such a fascinating person, such a real person who thought about things, thought about his reputation, thought about how do I make money? What do I do? And, you know, what kept him up at night? Because you can read their letters, but it's, you got to read between the lines and you got to think about, okay, someone with this type of money, this is what they're probably going through or feeling or thinking or coming through that decision points. And to me, that was fascinating, sort of peering behind the curtain and mm-hmm. understanding them in a little bit different way than we would normally think about them.
Yeah. Now, so if I'm understanding you correctly, financial resiliency doesn't have to do with putting a specific amount in the bank. It has to do with, well, the way that you define it, financial strength is a function of experience coupled with personality and determination.
I was going to say, I think that's true. And I do think it also comes down to having money in the bank, but those attributes create the ability to do things like a cash reserve, to project ahead, to budget, right? And so looking at that definition of resiliency, and then you look across the presidents, there are some presidents who were incredibly resilient. You know, Herbert Hoover, we don't think of Herbert Hoover as a great president, right? He was a great man. The presidency was the worst 4 years probably of his life in that sense. But when you look at him with money, what you find is someone who was an orphan, who was taught to budget at an early age by his Quaker community. You know, think about it, this little 10-year-old has a guardian, a family member, but he has a financial guardian that he submits budgets to. And when you go into the records at the Hoover Library and you see this, you're like, wow, what is this teaching this young child? And what it taught him was that he could use budgeting and numbers to problem solve. And for him, that created a resiliency. That was his superpower. So when you project throughout Hoover's life, both personally and professionally, you see moments where he clearly relies on those financial skills like budgeting to make decisions. And you know, the big thing that you think of with him and the legacy is feeding Europe not once, but twice after both world wars. You wouldn't have been able to do those projects like he did if he didn't have the financial skills that he started learning when he was 8, 9, 10 years old. And that's what's really important there. And it tells you a lot about him as a person.
We really owe a lot to his Quaker community as well, don't we?
Yeah. And the values, right? Like values are something that these presidents grew up with. Hmm. And, you know, I think about presidents like Calvin Coolidge, right? Calvin Coolidge, if I said, if he was alive today and we said, how are you financially? He would tell you he's thrifty. He's a budgeter, but he's also, I mean, he's cheap, right?
Yeah.
And it's funny because when you go into his letters, you know, he grew up, you know, very difficultly because he lost his mother and a sister at an early age, but his father lived into old age and his father had money. And in his letters, he was always asking his dad for allowance. His dad paid him an allowance, but Coolidge himself was very thrifty. And he and his wife, Grace, you know, when they first got married, they stayed at a boarding house and eventually, and they loved it. It was a screaming deal. And then the boarding house shuts down. And what does Calvin and Grace do? They buy all the silverware, the plates with all the branding, the bedding, because they could get it at a cheap deal. Uh-huh. So I love this idea that his values were being thrifty. And then you look at him in the White House, right? And he, you know, in the roaring 20s, everybody's having a party and he's sort of lecturing the American public about being thrifty. Right. And, you know, it's sort of a juxtaposition and maybe they should have listened to him.
Maybe they should have.
But they would have survived better. But I love the fact that their values like that come through as they're navigating how to be resilient, how to survive financially, like we all are.
Yeah. So tell us just a little bit more about the ingredients that an individual needs in order to become financially resilient. So you've mentioned values. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming perhaps lessons learned in childhood. What are the other essential ingredients?
Yeah. And I got a lot of these attributes by looking at my clientele, right? Okay. My clients are very wealthy individuals. And I was always saying, why is this one successful? This one struggles more. I would tell you risk. Embracing of risk is really important. The ability to project your future self. You know, Cara, who, are you going to like the Cara who's there in 20, 30, 40 years? And do you see her as a friend? Because if you do, you're going to save some money for her today to help her in retirement. Education matters. And we know this today. But we also had a number of presidents who didn't go to college. You know, and I would tell you that working hard and who you marry is incredibly important. You know, when you think about values with money, if you marry somebody with different money values, you're going to constantly be butting heads. And somebody in my role, in my day-to-day job, I work with a lot of married couples. And a lot of it is making sure we continue to focus on having shared values. And those values can be charity, right? Those values can be making sure we save money for the kids' education. Things that seem obvious, but when there's a misalignment, money can go awry. But the one trait that I found interesting, and my clients would often reiterate this, when I would start working with a new client, I'd ask them, how did you make the money? And they would tell me their story and they'd say, and I worked hard and I got lucky. And this concept of luck is always out there. We all attribute a lot to luck. And luck is something that is there and factors into money. And it's about consistency. And the president I always love thinking about when I think about luck is Jimmy Carter. Because one thing you find over the course of Jimmy Carter's life is, besides having strong values and very comfortable with risk, he was good with money. Jimmy Carter was very consistent in his behavior. And that allowed him to be incredibly financially successful. And he married well. He married a woman, Rosalind Carter, who was unbelievable with numbers. She was the bookkeeper for the farm. He was lucky to have married her because she knew numbers really, really well. And that helped them grow the Carter Farms. So again, these attributes that you see, I wanted to look at them from looking at my clients and tell you how you can use them, but using the presidents as a way to express it. Because they're a group of people that all of us know. And what's fascinating, I'll give you this one interesting insight. Once the book has come out, what I found in doing speaking engagements on it is when we talk about the presidents, not politically, but we talk about Lincoln or Jefferson or Roosevelt, we tap into our childhoods. There is something about the presidents that I find once we talk about their money, people get excited because it reminds them of childhood and when they learned about them. And you're a Jefferson scholar. People probably pepper you with questions. I mean, God help the guy or gal who focuses on Rutherford B. Hayes. But like Jefferson, we all know and love, you know, and we feel a connection to them. So understanding how those attributes in building wealth, if they worked or didn't work with a president, I think is very helpful for people.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. Actually, a lot of people come up to me and rather than peppering me with questions, they just want to tell me their opinions. So Jefferson is so well known and maybe so controversial. Everybody's already made up their mind about him. But I loved the chapter that you wrote that dealt with Jefferson. And in particular, you use him as an example of the characteristic that you define as connecting with your future self. So you mentioned this is something that I should do if I like future Kara. I need to plan well for my financial future. You'll be pleased to know I'm meeting with my tax advisor right after this podcast recording, by the way.
Perfect.
Yes, I'm working on it. But Jefferson, so you talk about him connecting with his future self. Can you tell us a bit more about how that characteristic did or did not work out in Jefferson's personal financial journey?
Yeah. So when you're, by the way, they study this concept of future self and money. It's actually NYU Stern School does a lot of research on this. And what they have found is that when people think of themselves older, if they see that person as a friend and that person they're willing to connect with and they do things for. And the people that don't see that person as a friend, more as a stranger, aren't able to act in that person's best interest. And they do this by studying the brain and how different sections of the brain light up. And when you work with someone like me, and you've probably have had been asked this question, they'll tell, you know, you get asked questions all the time, like, what does retirement look like? Where do you see yourself financially in 10, 20, 30 years? We're trying to trigger that part of your brain. Now, when we take this to Jefferson, we have to remember it was a very difficult situation being a plantation owner. Right? Mm-hmm. Take away the moral issues of slavery right now, but just owning land, owning illiquid assets, right? Dealing with crops. You had to You had to be incredibly on top of it, or you had to find someone to do that. Now, when you look at our founding fathers, right, the best one with money was George Washington.
Right.
And George Washington, partly it was because he, even though his father had money, George Washington, when his father died, didn't get any money really from the will. Mm-hmm. And he had to figure out a way to make money. And so George Washington very early on learned the hard work he had to do to build wealth and then sustain wealth. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating in Washington's letters is even during the Revolution, he's always managing his estate. Yep. You see him, he sells pieces of land. He's talking about crops. He's very focused on managing the plantations. Yeah. Jefferson, not as much, right? And partly it was because I think you get caught up in everything that's going on and it's very hard to find someone to be a manager of your plantation. Right. Jefferson struggled with it. Madison, Monroe all struggled finding people. And so with Jefferson in particular, what people are fascinated about is here's this brilliant guy. You know, he knows food, he knows wine, he lives a gorgeous lifestyle. His home is stunning. But what we forget about is that near the end of his life, and you know this as a scholar, his house was falling apart. Monticello was not in top condition. And a lot of it was he was never able to really get ahead of the burdens of plantation life, of the expenses. And he was spending and he wasn't managing the illiquidity of the situation. And when we have that, what happens with a lot of people is they become ostriches and they put their head in the sand. And you see that with Jefferson. You see that with James Monroe, the ability of I'll deal with it tomorrow. And we all know people like this. We all do this, right? We have a stressful financial situation. It's I can't think about it. I'll deal with it tomorrow.
Hope it gets better overnight.
I hope it gets better. And what happens is it doesn't, right? Mm-hmm. And I see this from time to time, particularly today. You know, we've got so many stresses on us with student loan debt, with childcare, caring for elderly parents, saving for retirement. And, the, you know, cost of living doesn't always increase at the pace that everything else is. People today get in this situation very, very easily. And so we have a little bit of Thomas Jefferson in us. And that's what's hard. So Jefferson's heartbreaking, as you know, because at the end of his life, he has to consider putting Monticello up for auction. And you could still see in the Saturday Evening Post, the ad offering tickets for the auction. He was going to auction up Monticello to pay off his debts. And of course, people tell him this is not really a good look, not to do this, that they would help. So he takes it off of auction. They don't really help him much. He subsequently dies. He's in debt. He does some things in his estate plan to try to protect his daughter, but it's not enough. And the house does go up for auction, as you know, after his death. And so it's sort of a tragic footnote for somebody who was so brilliant, such a great thinker and writer and you know, founding father. But again, it's probably the ability, those skills that allowed him to dream and really do great things like that were probably also the negative aspect was he couldn't connect with his future self. And in the book, I talk about this, there's presidents like Warren Harding who are the opposite, great with connecting with their future self, not great presidents.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, you're so right. Jefferson was a visionary. He was extremely optimistic, at least in his early years, about the future of America, about the moral trajectory of the country. He hoped that slavery would end. He hoped that Americans would become more virtuous. He hoped all of these things about liberty spreading across the globe. But you mentioned that he experienced a lot of death and loss in his personal life. Many family members passed away. Many children passed away. And you said if somebody were to ask him, you know, as a young man, where do you see yourself in 30 years? He probably would have said dead.
Right. Which is realistic, right?
It would have been realistic. And instead, he ended up living until his 80s. And unfortunately, his bad financial planning combined with, you mentioned, luck, a series of very unlucky events as well, really devastated his finances. So just going back to this concept of connecting with your future self quickly, does this have to do with self-esteem? Is somebody with low self-esteem less likely to be good at planning for their financial future because they don't care about their future self in the same way?
That's an interesting question. I think there could be an element to that, right? I think when you look at people across the spectrum of wealth in America, right, from low income to ultra high income, I think that that probably plays in more on the lower end of the spectrum, because I think people beat themselves up if they're not able to handle their finances. What I find interesting is when I work with people, and it happens a lot with women, right out of the gate, they'll be like, listen, I'm not that good with money, right? Oh. I hear that a lot, or from young people. I don't really know anything about money. And I always say, add the word yet to that. I don't know a lot about money yet, or I'm not good with money yet, because that changes the whole tonal aspect of I'm not good with money. And I do think people do, the inability to connect with their future self, it could be self-esteem related, but I also feel that when you start to explain it to them, they are able to understand the concept of future self, what I want to be, where do I want to go, what is the steps I have to take. Now, what's hard for most people in this country is there's a group of Americans who have opportunity, right? They have income, they have good salary, they have bonuses, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have a group of Americans who don't have opportunity. So it doesn't matter how good a budgeter you are. It doesn't matter if you can connect with your future self. If you don't even have the right level of income coming in, you're struggling. And that's where I think, you know, day to day, I think that's why it's gotten harder in the US than ever before to have financial resiliency. It's always been hard, but today you have so many things coming at you that make it harder. And so I think it's something that everybody struggles with, but the people who in the lower income brackets, even more so.
Okay. Well, in this same chapter where you discuss Thomas Jefferson and the ways in which he did not connect well with his future self, he did not plan very well for the future, buried his head in the sand. He was big on promoting America's international reputation by hosting people well and giving them good amounts of food and wine when they came to the White House or even uninvited to visit him at Monticello, but terrible at totaling up his income and losses and realizing that he needed to be better at budgeting. There's a lot to be learned from the ways that he failed to handle money well. And in fact, it took his grandson's entire lifetime to pay off all of the Jefferson family debts. So at least there was one member of the Jefferson family who was good with money.
He had to figure it out. Somebody had
to take responsibility for this.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
You also talk in that same chapter about Joe Biden and the same concept of future self. Did Biden do this better than Jefferson? And if so, how, why?
You know, Biden and Jefferson both had a lot of horrible things happen with death and family members throughout their lives. And I will tell you, when you work with people who've been through trauma and you're working with them on your on their finances, the key thing in that is you're supposed to slow them down. Right? Slow them down to focus on their decision making. But Joe Biden's an interesting person in the sense that what we often forget about Joe Biden is when he was born in 1942, his family was quite successful. The Bidens were on their way to being wealthy. His father was involved in manufacturing that had thrived during the war. But when the war ended, the business fell apart. And that's when the Bidens went from vacationing in Massachusetts on Cape Cod to being in Scranton. Right. So he always starts his story with Scranton, but there's actually a few years where he was, you know, living a very different lifestyle. And he was a baby. Oh, wow. But I think the thing with Joe Biden is, you know, he's ambitious, he's scrappy, and he moves to Wilmington, Delaware very early in life. Right. And if you've ever been to Wilmington, Delaware, it's blue blood American, like old money, right? It's gorgeous, right? It's why all the banks are there. And it's stunning. And I think Joe Biden grew up seeing these gorgeous homes and aspiring. But I think what was problematic for Joe Biden is having some of the traumas he went through, losing his wife, losing his daughter. His financial decision making becomes frenetic. And I don't address this in the book, but I think the other thing it made his financial decision-making do is become overindulgent with his children. And I say that because today we weaponize money against whoever is running for office, right? Whether it's right or wrong. But I think with Joe Biden, you know, this ability to be overindulgent with your children gets him into a lot of financial predicaments. Because again, he's not thinking ahead that if I help Hunter here, if I help, you know, my daughter here, that this is how it's going to be perceived. Yeah. And I'll give you a quick example. When you're working with high net worth people, you know, they want to give their kids money to get them into homes or, you know, do things like that, or, you know, help family members out. But we do what we call below market loans, which is we make a loan to them and we use a rate set by the IRS every month and we document it with a note. We make payments, all of this stuff. There's a formal loan to it. And Biden did this with his brother. He made him a very short-term loan, but yet didn't document it, didn't ever like show that this was an agreement, that they used the below market rate from the IRS. And so it's a sloppiness and an overindulgence to your family members and not thinking ahead that making loans could make you look bad in the political eye. So with Biden, that's where sometimes his lack of connecting with future self undoes himself, is not projecting ahead and thinking this may hurt me down the line as well.
So felt like generosity at the time, but you're saying it was actually not a wise financial decision for him personally. Was it ultimately harmful to his children as well, or something that worked out well for them?
When I work with clients, or particularly people who are prominent, the threshold question you always have to ask them is, how would this look on the cover of the Wall Street Journal? Right. That will usually catch people in their place. So people are, people being overindulgent with your children, it's very common. But when you say to someone who's prominent, look, making this loan to a brother or a child, and you're not following all the strict rules of making loans, how will this look on the cover of the Wall Street Journal? Project ahead, look at how your future self is going to have to deal with this issue. That can come back and burn you. So yeah. I think with Biden, he's been financially successful, but his financial success, I would tell you not is from skills or traits, but because another president laid down the path for making building wealth after the presidency. And that president's Gerry Ford. So pre-Ford, right, presidents left the White House and they either died, like Washington, FDR, right? Mm-hmm. They went back to practicing law. Lincoln was going to go back and practice law, mm-hmm. you know, or they wrote a book, right? There was that was sort of like Eisenhower and Truman. Mm-hmm. That was sort of the path. But Gerry Ford is an interesting character in American history, right? He's never been elected, does a lot of tough things as president, and he's very bold with money. He did not grow up with money. He talks a lot about growing up as a child and reading Horatio Alger stories at night in bed about boys who would use their smarts and their strengths to, you know, go out into the world. And so Ford, when he finishes the presidency, is only worth a couple hundred thousand dollars. He doesn't have a lot of money. And interestingly enough, when he was a congressman, he had voted against presidents getting pensions. His newsletter. Yeah, he was like, this doesn't make sense. So here he is, he's leaving the White House and he's like, I'm like 62 years old. I'm young. Like, what am I going to do? Golf all day? Which he does golf. But he hires a talent agent from William Morris Endeavor named Norm Brokaw. And they come up with a strategy. How are they going to make money? Speeches, a book, the first joint book deal with a first lady, and entrepreneurial endeavors. And he does some things that I talk about in the book, but the thing that Ford makes money on is he goes on corporate boards because he sees the world very differently, makes a lot of money from these corporate boards from consulting fees and stock. Right. And he lays down the path that every president subsequently does. The Obamas have a production company, the Clintons and their speeches, right? The Bidens, you know, wrote books. So again, Joe Biden, going back to him, I don't think Joe Biden has great financial skills. I don't think he takes advice well, but lucky for him, Gerry Ford built the path for them. And Biden just signed with a CAA, a talent agent, a la Gerry Ford.
Interesting. I think George Washington would hate all of this, by the way. I think the founding generation, they would say this is not the path politicians should go on, that they should devote their lives to public service and then retire quietly back to their farms and their regular jobs. But the world has changed quite a lot since the 1700s, hasn't it?
It has, but I think Washington gives good guidance. You know, Washington thought a lot about his reputation throughout his whole life, right? Doesn't take a salary when he's the commander of the Revolutionary Army, but he tells Congress, you got to pay my expenses. Well, Congress didn't realize it was going to be an 8-year war and the best budgeter ever was in charge. Washington's expenses are gorgeous. I mean, they're beautifully written out and he saved every receipt. It was $160,000 of expenses that Congress had to pay him. But Washington, you see it, thinks about his reputation constantly and does things that actually is against his best financial interests in order to preserve his reputation.
That's right.
And, you know, quickly at the end of his life or at the end of his presidency, he was given $20,000 of stock of the James Canal River Company. And he could have used it. He could have used the liquidity, but he knew it was not a good look. And Washington couldn't go to college. His dad didn't, you know, make it and put it in the estate plan. And that always bugged him.
Yeah.
And so he always did things to help kids go to college. And in Washington's case, he went to Henry Lightfoot Lee and said, Lighthorse Lee and says, hey, you know, what should I do about this stock? And they decide they're going to donate it to a school in Virginia. And they put it out there and schools apply. And this school called the Liberty Hall wins the grant from Washington of this $20,000 of stock. It eventually becomes Washington Academy and eventually becomes Washington and Lee University.
Right.
But here, Washington could have done with that stock to help with his liquidity issues. Yeah. But he knew that reputation thing is a tricky thing. And he was not willing to go down that path. And I wish people today followed the Washington example more. It is something that I think is commendable what Washington did, and especially given the fact that nobody was holding him up to a high standard then. He held himself up to the high standard.
Yeah. And there's a reason that he was unanimously elected and that he is still consistently at the top of Americans' perceptions when they're rating their different presidents. I think he absolutely deserves that because
he totally was
almost obsessed with his own reputation and integrity.
Yeah. And but by the way, he set the trend with presidents. He is our first president who married up. And it's a love match, But what I find fascinating with these presidents is a lot of them married wealthier women, not just in the Washington timeframe, but, you know, Lincoln, you've got Eisenhower, you've got Johnson. These guys all found a way to climb the socioeconomic ladder, partially by who they married.
Right. Okay, so you've just mentioned two of the things that I want to still ask you about. One was education and going to college. Mm-hmm. The second is choosing the right spouse. Let's focus on the spouse issue for a second. Yes. So you say in your book that this is one of the most important decisions individuals can make in securing their financial futures. Mm-hmm. Why? Why does it matter so very much who you marry? Is it just about marrying somebody with more money than you that is going to make a big difference mm-hmm. to your future? What matters about the choice in your spouse, and which presidents best exemplify this for you?
It's about alignment of values, alignment of priorities, right? When you're married, okay. right, and you're making decisions about your finances, are we going to buy a house? Are we going to save for our children's education? You have to be in agreement. And you have to be in agreement because a lot of finance is about discipline. And I think the Lincolns are a good example of where it goes awry, right? Mm. Lincoln goes through a number of financial mishaps earlier in his life. But by the time he's married to Mary Todd, you know, he's learned some discipline. And Mary Todd, not so much. She's a bit of a spender. And when they're in the White House, Lincoln's taking half of every paycheck. And he was getting $25,000 a year, which was a lot of money back then. Uh-huh. And he was saving it in U.S. Treasury bonds and notes that were yielding like 6 or 7%, right? Aligning uh-huh. himself with the Union Army. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, Mary's off in New York buying clothing, plates, right? Gloves, all these crazy stories about her. And she tells Mrs. Keckley, her dressmaker, yeah. when Lincoln's running for a second term, like, he needs to win because if he doesn't, he's going to find out about all this debt. So very, very misaligned in terms of marriage. Yeah. But you look at some of the great marriages of the presidents, the Reagans, right? Yeah. Ronald Reagan and Ronald Nancy Reagan were very well matched in terms of finances. Both of them grew up poor. Now, Nancy grew up in a better situation than Ronald did because her mother remarried, but both of them grew up with learning the value of money, of how you have to work your way up. And for Ronald Reagan, this was important because Ronald Reagan grew up poor. You know, father was an alcoholic. They would, you know, constantly struggling to survive. But by the time he gets to Hollywood, he's learned about budgeting. He's good at budgeting. He's making $10,000 a year, and he meets Jane Wyman, and they fall in love and they get married. Jane Wyman comes from a poor background. Reagan's a saver. Jane Wyman, she's a spender. And she complains about it in the Hollywood magazines. Ronnie's has a phobia about bills. Ronnie doesn't like debt. And they butt heads a lot. Uh-oh. So I'm not saying the money was the only reason they broke up. There were a number of reasons, but they were very misaligned financially. He was much more aligned with Nancy Reagan. So it's incredibly important. And when you look at the great partnerships, LBJ and Lady Bird, Ike and Mamie, like, they were aligned financially.
That's fascinating. So it has to do with the longevity of your marriage, but also perhaps with your own ability to succeed financially and in your career. If you have a spouse whose values line up with yours and they are supportive of your values, together you can go further.
Yeah, I mean, Mamie Eisenhower grew up incredibly wealthy with servants, you know, in Denver, Colorado. Mm-hmm. And she meets Ike, who grew up poor. He's in the military. He's making like $127 a month. They're not. Mm-hmm. Now, when they get married, she realizes she has to make sacrifice. But her father also gives Ike an allowance when they get married, because Mamie has to be kept in a certain level of standard. So I always found that interesting.
Thank you, Dad.
Thank you. And the other thing is, Ike originally talked about it wasn't the Air Force at the time because we didn't have an official Air Force. He wanted to go learn how to fly planes. Right. And Mamie's father's like, no, you're going to make my daughter a widow? No. You are staying in the Army. Wow. And he was, even though that going to fly planes would have been a salary increase for Ike. So again, there was Mamie sacrificed stuff, but Ike sacrificed stuff. And I think that sacrifice allowed them to get along quite well financially.
Fascinating. Okay, now the second topic that I still wanted to ask about was the role of education in helping presidents overcome fragility and becoming successful in their lives. Now, you specifically talk about college, mm-hmm. and a lot of these presidents had the opportunity to go to college. Many did not. You say that just going to college by itself is not necessarily enough. And you discuss the importance of networking. Tell us a little bit more about that. Why is going to the right college or doing the right things while at college an important part of financial success?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, we are all aware of the Ivy League system, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you get entree into that level of education, whether it's, you know, going to the right prep school, college, and so on, and then the right clubs at these colleges, right? You are getting an access to a network that will allow you to build your career. Take George H.W. Bush, comes from a wealthy family, goes to Yale after World War II, finishes Yale in 3 years. And H.W. was fascinating young guy. He could have taken his family connections and went right to Wall Street. He does something really wild. He goes the other direction. He goes into the oil industry and moves Barbara and young George W. to Texas. And it's really rough down there. It's not what they came up from, but he took a harder path. It doesn't seem like a harder path when we look back on it, but for mm-hmm. him to break away from the network of people he was tied into, that was a big deal. But the other thing these education gives is access, right? So you look at the two presidents we have who had student loan debt, which is Bill Clinton with Yale and Barack Obama with both Occidental, Columbia, because he transferred in his undergrad years, and then Harvard. All of them took on debt because they were very willing to understand that going to Yale Law or Harvard Law was getting them access to a very different opportunity set than they could get elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But we also have presidents who didn't get college educated and did just fine. Right. Now, the last president was Harry Truman, but
President who did not go to college.
Did not go to college. Okay. But I think the thing is this, college has gotten so expensive in the US. What we need to think about as a country is, does everyone need to go to college now? Like there are certain career paths mm-hmm. like yours, Cara, you got to go to college to, yep. you know, be a professor and be in academia. You know, I'm an attorney by training. You got to go to college, but it really isn't the right fit for everybody right. because what we need to focus on is not getting out of school and getting a good salary, which is how I was told when I was going to school.
Yeah.
We need to focus on how much debt are you going to come out with college so that it doesn't impede you from building net worth. Building net worth is key. And the kids that have come out in the last 15 years came out with all the student loan debt. So buying a house became so much harder than it did for generations before. And so these are the discussions we got to think about, because when you look back at the presidents and you look back at Washington and Lincoln, who didn't go to college, Harry Truman, they had to use other skills to get ahead and self-educate themselves. So these are the things to think about. But again, very challenging getting education today. And I think you see that with the story of Barack Obama.
Yeah. Lincoln is another interesting person to consider when we're thinking about college and education. He famously did not go to college, largely self-taught. He only had a few months of formal schooling. I love you. You quoted a biography that he wrote for himself. Congress was apparently putting together a collection of biographies of current living members. And they wrote and asked Lincoln to send them a little autobiography. And so here's how he described himself. He gives his birthday, Hardin County, Kentucky, education defective, profession a lawyer, postmaster at a very small office, 4 times a member of the Illinois legislature and was a member of the lower house of Congress. Yours, A. Lincoln. Short and to the point. Now, I love this. He describes his own education as defective. But as you point out, and I completely agree, education was extremely important. It was Lincoln's ticket out of poverty. How did this work in Lincoln's life? He was able to succeed without needing networking, without needing an Ivy League school. What did education do for him?
Yeah, I mean, so what's really interesting is, first of all, I think it's a great example of deflection, right? I think when you don't go to college, and I often think about this with Washington hanging out with Thomas Jefferson, mm-hmm. how he must have felt like his self-worth, like, oh my God, these guys, you know, he, William and Mary, and he got Princeton and Madison. And, you know, I feel for these guys because they're probably up against these Harvard people or Yale and feeling like, can I compete? So right. I think Lincoln's way of doing that was clever. But these people were very, very driven. You know, Abraham Lincoln, well, he didn't get access to going to formal schooling. He was always reading. Right. He was always trying to educate himself, always trying to get his hands on books. And he understood the power of reading and of learning storytelling. So whatever he missed out on in formal education, he was able to self-educate himself. And I think that's incredibly important. You know, and I'm always shocked today when I read these stories, how kids in school don't read full books anymore. And I think that's so sad because books are still my friends. Like it's so, but Lincoln and Washington found ways to sort of get around this hurdle, right? They got over it. And that to me is really important. But it was also society at the time was a little more accepting of it, if you think about it. So, you know, Lincoln's learning, though, also came from failure. You know, when Lincoln leaves his father's household at age 21, he goes to New Salem and he gets into this business partnership and with William Berry. They decide to buy a store and money's cheap. They get all this inventory. They buy a second store. They got all these debt. The stores fail. And then William Berry does the convenient thing and drops dead. So Lincoln inherits his debt. Lincoln takes on the debt. It was $1,100 and Lincoln cleverly, you know, would call it my national debt. Because he's a funny guy.
Yes.
And $1,100 in 1835 is like $40,000 today. So it was sort of like he had student loan debt.
Yeah.
And when you go into Lincoln's finances before he becomes an attorney, I mean, he's not a great postmaster. You know, he gets taken to court because he bought a saddle on credit and never pays. Like he's financially messy. But Lincoln's a learning being. He's intellectually curious. So the good news with Lincoln is with every failure he has, he's showing resiliency, not because he failed, but because he bounces back from it. Uh-huh. And that's the difference between Lincoln's time and today. If someone started a business today and failed, it would be very hard to bounce back from it like Lincoln did. And Lincoln does. I mean, Lincoln, when you go in his finances, Lincoln learned loaning money was very productive. You know, when he goes to DC to be president, he rents out the beautiful house he has on 8th and Jackson in Springfield. And Lincoln, when he left for the presidency, he was worth $15,000, about half a million. When he dies, he's worth $85,000 or about $2 million in our money.
Wow. Despite Mary Todd's shopping problems.
But here's the weird thing. This is a guy who's an attorney. He has premonitions of his own death.
Yeah.
And he dies without an estate plan. So what does Robert Todd Lincoln have to do? They get the Chief Justice of the United States to come in and become the executor and gather all the assets. And when you die intestate, Mary Lincoln only gets the spousal share, which was a third of the estate. Tad gets a third and Robert gets a third. And so, you know, very messy estate planning. And I'm always like wondering, like, Lincoln, you were so brilliant. Like, you know, why did you not have an estate plan? Because he made it very messy for them at the end.
That's maybe a good final lesson for us to learn. Always have a will.
Always have an estate plan. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we're just about out of time, but let me ask you one final thing. What was the most interesting fact that you learned about a president while you were researching for this book? You've already told us many, many interesting things. If you had to pick one.
You know, FDR was really fun because when FDR saved everything, because his was supposed to, he was the one who decided to do presidential libraries like we do today. And so it was fun going to his library, going through his personal finance stuff. But one thing I found was correspondence with the IRS. And they wrote him in 1926 and said, Mr. Roosevelt, you failed to file a tax return. You know, where is it? And he writes back a very FDR-esque reply like, well, I was going from Warm Springs to New York. My brother died. I lost the papers along the way. I'll get it to you. And it's very charming and charismatic. And of course, he does eventually get them the tax return. And he used to do his tax returns by hand. They actually have in the library the work papers of him calculating the stock sales and so on. But I loved the fact that FDR and that persona that we know and love from the fireside chats in World War II, there he is trying to get out of the IRS, giving him a hard time, you know, with that charm and charisma. And he does pay his taxes appropriately, just to be clear there.
That's a good detail to note. Wow. Well, Megan, thank you so much for making the time to speak to us today and giving us all of these really interesting lessons about the presidents that we've had, but also really applicable tips for all of our own lives and these issues where we have a lot in common with the presidents. We are all human beings who need to deal with finances and the fear surrounding finances in each of our own lives. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
All righty. Everybody, have a great day. We'll see you next time on The American Idea.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.